Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. Today we are coming to you from the Fred W. Smith Forum inside the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the MU campus. Along with our panelists, we also have a live audience that we hope will share their expertise on today's topic. If you are a regular listener, you no doubt have heard me say that one of the goals of this program is to get you to participate in our conversation, either to ask a question of our panelists or, even better, to share what you know about the topic at hand. In other words, we want to engage you. That idea of engagement has become a buzzword across a wide spectrum of industries and institutions. Whether it's political campaigns, media outlets, nonprofit groups, or companies that sell snacks, it seems everyone is trying to engage their respective followers, especially since new technologies promise to make it even easier for people to connect. So today we're going to talk about what that goal of engagement really means. We'll hear how various people from different sectors are going after it, and we'll explore how this focus on engagement is changing the way our world fits together. Joining me at the table today, first, Jana Byington-Smith is the founder of ROI Philanthropy Partners and is the president of Second Gift. She consults with nonprofit organizations and advises them on ways to recruit and retain donors. Thanks for driving in from St. Louis, Jana Byington-Smith.
Thank you.
Glad to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
Also with us today, Joy Mayer is an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and is the director of community outreach for the Columbia, Missouri News Organization. Last year, she studied news audience engagement as part of a fellowship at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Welcome to the program, Joy Mayer.
Thank you, Ruben.
Glad to have you with us as well. And we also have at the table Sam Robinson. He is the director of Healthy Community Initiatives for PetNet, an organization here in Columbia that promotes alternative forms of transportation. He works directly with community volunteers on a variety of civic projects. Welcome to our program, Sam Robinson.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you as well. We have a number of other guests in the room who have expertise in this area, and we hope that they'll join the conversation as well. We also hope to hear from you and our audience. What experiences have you had in the area of engagement, either with mobilizing others on behalf of a cause or on the other side as a volunteer or donor? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. You can also join our conversation online by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Let's start with this question. Joy, what does it even mean when we talk about that word engagement?
I think it means different things depending on the perspective. You know, sometimes that means brand loyalty. Sometimes it means, I think really at the heart it means connection to an idea, feeling emotionally invested in a product or a cause or a situation.
Jana, what might you add to that?
Well, I think there's two elements to engagement. One is the kind of a more global perspective. How do we all relate to each other if we look at segments in industry or government or not-for-profit? And then I think, you know, engagement can be measured. It is the amount of time someone spends thinking about that idea, working on that idea or supporting it, you know, financially or with in advocacy.
Right. Sam, when you think about engaging people with some of the PetNet programs, what are you going after? What are you hoping they're going to do?
Well, actually, we want to empower our individual stakeholders to become leaders in their own right so as to build an advocacy base that we can have a broad-based support of whatever issues we're facing at that time.
So can you give us an example of how that might play out?
Sure. We enlist the volunteerism of individual community members in our action team. So if you have a passion to garden, we may ask you to be part of our community garden action team. If you have a passion or desire to expand our public transportation, we ask you to join our comic team. So there's a variety of ways that we can plug you in. But more importantly, I think your passion drives what you're trying to accomplish both individually and as a community.
And why does this matter? Why is engagement something that everyone seems to think is so important these days? Jana, maybe you start us off with that.
I think there's a couple of elements I'd consider. I think it's important because things are moving pretty fast. People talk to each other in many different ways. They share ideas and communicate ideas very quickly. And having some, courses, some pathways to engagement where people can kind of depend on hearing information and responding to information is critical. And we should be considering when we make decisions, how do we make that pathway accessible to people who may care about it from a lot of different perspectives.
Right. Joy and Sam, you're both nodding. I mean, Joy, why would a news organization want to focus on this? I mean, news organizations are about providing information, right?
They are, but the thing that I think is so interesting that transcends disciplines and causes and businesses here is that it's so possible for people to participate. It's expected. The people expect to be able to participate in their lives in different ways than they used to. So the idea that that I would receive a message and nobody would have any idea whether that resonated with me and what action I plan to take as a result of it, they're just gone. Those days are gone. So it is expected that if I like a kind of cereal or like a news brand or believe in a cause like PedNet, that I will make that clear to people around me, that it becomes sort of part of my identity, that there are things that I can do to jump in and participate in that.
And what is that all about? Is that technology that has changed that, or is it other kinds of cultural shifts?
I would say there's major historical shifts. To speak very broadly, way too broadly perhaps, the demographics of a nation, of a world, mean that you have to be able to talk to each other differently, and we certainly do see age groups, different countries within each, approaching issues and communicating issues and ideas at different rates. And so the whole idea of building an understanding has become increasingly important. And measuring has become more important than ever before.
Right. Okay, let me remind everyone real fast. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the MU campus having a town hall discussion about community engagement. Joining me in the studio are Jana Byington-Smith, a donor retention expert and founder of ROI Philanthropy Partners, Joy Mayer, the director of community outreach for the Columbia, Missourian News Organization, and Sam Robinson, director of healthy community initiatives for PedNet. For those of you in our audience, what do you think are good strategies for building a sense of community and getting people to talk to each other and to talk back to your organizations? Share your thoughts by giving us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And if you have questions for our panelists, feel free to call in with those as well. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. I want to bring our audience into the conversation here.
Good afternoon. My name is Darren Priest. I'm with Central Missouri Community Action. I just wanted to add one element that we see in the nonprofit sector is really kind of a logistic issue, and that is for organizations that are trying to address very complex issues like poverty in our example, in our case, the demand is just simply too great. We have to engage the community, whether that's through individual volunteers or through other partner organizations. We just can't meet the demand ourselves. And even more importantly, we want to change the demand. We want to change the whole dynamic of why poverty exists, or why, if it's a transit issue, why isn't the system where it should be? So we just literally have to engage volunteers and individuals and other organizations just to meet our mission. And then also, again, logistically speaking, funders expect it of us. They see that the demand is too great, so they want to leverage whatever dollars that they are contributing to us, investing in us, and they expect us to leverage those dollars by engaging the community and making that effort go further.
Interesting. He mentioned the donor expectations. Jana, you work a lot with donor relations and donor issues. How much of it is driven by that sort of donor demand as opposed to other reasons that this engagement really matters to a lot of organizations?
Well, I think anyone who works in nonprofits will know people give for a lot of different reasons. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, a lot of folks say that there is a tax purpose or tax benefit to giving, when that actually ends up to be a very much lower level priority for donors. Usually it is because they care passionately about the feeling. They feel that there's a need that's could be overwhelming, that it needs more attention. They vote with their dollars that way. But I think you have an interesting point about there's just too much. And I think there's a moment we're experiencing in the nonprofit sector and its relationship with government, and its relationship with media, where we have to sort of innovate and break some rules about the volume of problem we're trying to manage. And to that end, I would suggest that in a way the nonprofit sector is innovating beyond what government and industry maybe can. And I'll use as an example the AIDS epidemic, that there are clinical understandings of the medical issue. And there's an understanding of resources for medical care. But until the not-for-profit sector really ramped up and started building a voice for community need as opposed to medical need, the governmental response, the Ryan White bill, wouldn't have happened. It truly is a blending of government and nonprofit development.
Joy, you're nodding, and we've offline talked about this idea of news organizations stepping into that arena as well. Talk a little bit about that from that perspective of a news organization trying to get into that problem-solving space.
It's so interesting how when we talk about civic engagement, newsrooms have a really a sort of odd line to walk between, you know, if we're covering a cause, we're trying something like poverty, we're trying to draw attention to poverty, and we're trying to give people the tools they would need to act if they choose, and yet we're not advocating on behalf of a specific solution necessarily. The mission of news organizations often expands to include empowering people to better live their lives and to get involved in their communities in a way that resonates with them and that feels appropriate for what they believe in. But it makes some journalists uncomfortable to think that we would go too far in that direction.
Right. We have a couple of questions from the chat room. One of them is directed specifically at you, Jana. A question about donors and the economy. It's tough economic times, and a lot of people, individual donors, not necessarily institutional donors, although they may be part of this, with the economy, is it difficult to get people to keep donating? And if so, how do you do that in these economic times?
Well, speaking to the in-studio question again, the donors really expect to be told that they're donations are being used for the purpose, that they're being used in a timely way to answer the problem or the concern, that the response is appropriate to the need. And, as we were talking earlier, Columbia is a great town for that particular issue. I think that there is a certain responsiveness that donors feel. If you have an interest in gardening, there is somewhere you can go, and you can see gardens being built, and that actual visual response is immediate in this town. I love Columbia for that. But I think donors really appreciate, assessment of the value and effectiveness of their gifts.
Right. And how does that play out on the other side? I mean, we're talking about people giving money. What about the volunteers? I mean, Darren, you mentioned that you mobilize a lot of people in the community to actually go address problems. Joy, your work is trying to engage readers to have a conversation. It's the same thing here on our program, right? We're trying to get the listeners and the viewers to engage and join the conversation. What are the things that work in terms of connecting? I mean, this was a question posed by Sam in the chat room. What are the tools that help you connect with an audience? And we'll get to the second part of his question in a bit.
I think that depends on where the conversation's taking place and on what the situation is. What we have found is that sometimes people enjoy being publicly credited for a contribution, and that makes people feel connected and like they're being heard. I think when a brand or an institution takes the time to engage in smaller conversations and give personal shout-outs to people, that can make a difference. In news, we talk a lot about social identity and how being part of a cause or a story or a message or a brand can contribute to that. So we've done some experimenting with how we can make reading our content, participating with us in a conversation, voting in an election, how can we allow people to help that contribute to the social identity that they're building?
Right. Sam, what have you found that works in terms of mobilizing people to participate?
Well, I think something that we also need to explore and learn more about in our community is cultural competence. I think that's important that our messaging is cultural competent, not only messaging, but our interaction with different cultures within cultures, institutional and individual. So we need to make a conscious effort to be sensitive to the message that we're sending and also we're receiving from our constituents. And I can give an example of that.
That'd be great, yeah.
If we're working in our low-income neighborhoods, we need to make sure that we're having meetings at the time that they can meet. You know, typically I work an 8-to-5 or 9-to-5 job, but that doesn't necessarily work for a mother of three small children that wants to be involved but just can't because they're either obligated in other ways. So we need to be adaptive to our approaches and flexible in our scheduling.
Right. Darren, anything to add to that?
A couple quick things. Darren Priest again at Central Missouri Community Action. It's good to build on what Sam was saying. I think that really acknowledging what motivates people, and it may be the appreciation, it may be some level of authority in whatever it is they're volunteering with and the engagement, but really recognizing what drives them and responding to that individual need. I just had thought of an example when Sam was talking. Sam and I both were at a Stop the Violence meeting the other day. There's been an outburst of violence in Columbia recently, and I was kind of in the back of the room and was listening to some of the younger folks in the room, and they were throwing out some suggestions about a march that they were proposing to put out there. And the youth were suggesting things that were not being embraced by the people running the meeting. And I just thought it was just such a missed opportunity because the kids in the back were just kind of shaking their heads and saying, here we go again. You know, it's another adult-driven solution that probably isn't going to work. And I thought that was pretty telling. And I wanted to respond, Ruben, also you'd asked about what's the media's responsibility in the engagement process. And I think just recently Columbia Tribune had a writer's roundtable to look at the issue of poverty, and I was so impressed that they did this. Basically, they got together the writers that may or may not have some sort of story in the next 6 months that is either affected by or that affects stories around poverty, and they brought in 5 or 6 of us just to talk about what we're seeing, what do the numbers look like, what are our interventions, what's the impact of our interventions. And we just had a conversation, and they were taking notes and asking questions, and they really were taking it upon themselves to deeply understand the issue. Sometimes I know when I do interviews, and if the reporter isn't familiar with the issue that they're asking me about to some level of detail, then sometimes the story gets skewed in ways that really I hadn't intended or that isn't real. And so I think that the media's responsibility is to really deeply understand the issues that they're interviewing about. I think Brian maybe had a comment too also on the engagement side.
Yeah, my name is Brian White, and I'm also with Central Missouri Community Action. And I've been fortunate in the last year and a half to be working with the group Columbia Cares for Kids. And basically, I wanted to kind of tag on to what Sam had said, that everybody's got something that they can bring to the table. It's about taking ownership of that issue and then, I guess, owning your own behaviors and thinking about how you can impact that positively. And one of the real benefits that I've seen with engaging the community in our Columbia Cares for Kids initiative is, like Darren said, it's more than anybody can do alone. But also, just in my job day to day, I get stagnant. I don't get new ideas. I don't think about new things. And when you get a whole table of people that have similar missions and causes and working independently out there thinking, why not come together? I mean, that kind of feeds my thought process, and it gets me excited and motivated to move to the next level. And we do know what we're currently doing oftentimes is not the answer. And we need those ideas. We need people to be free to share those ideas, and that includes the community at large. So I appreciate what you're trying to do here. So thank you.
Thanks. Let me remind everyone again what we are doing here. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the MU campus having a town hall discussion about community engagement. Joining me in the studio are Jana Byington-Smith, a donor retention expert and founder of ROI Philanthropy Partners, Joy Mayer, the director of community engagement and community outreach for the Columbia, Missouri News Organization, and Sam Robinson, Director of Healthy Community Initiatives for PedNet. For those of you in our audience, what does it take for an organization or company to win your trust and get you to interact with them? Share your thoughts by giving us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to give our panelists a chance to respond to some of what we heard just before I did that announcement in the middle. In terms of engaging communities and needing those ideas in order to move things forward, maybe, Sam, you start us off there.
Yeah, I want to thank Brian and Darren for their comments. I want to also kind of segue of your comment regarding how do we leverage or sustain our projects. And I think one way that we're looking at leveraging our projects within PetNet is a policy-driven approach, meaning that how can we institutionalize our programs, so taking program to policy. But more importantly, you can do all you can to engage a community member, but if there's not a infrastructure that supports them socially, economically, and politically, the behaviors aren't going to match up with the desired outcome. So I think we need to also look at those barriers.
Okay. Another one of our audience participants here joining the conversation.
Yes, my name is Stephanie Padgett. I'm one of the assistant professors in strategic communications. And I think one of the dangers or scariest things about engagement is it's really about a two-way conversation. And so when you said, gosh, what tools do people use to engage? It's really part of your body. It's these two things called your ears. And so I think we often skip to the mobile and the technology because they're cool. But if we really aren't listening, much in the case of when the kids come, they want to participate, it really kills engagement early on. And I think a lot of brands are a lot of times scared to really listen and engage. I want to engage, but it's one and a half of a conversation, really not a two-way conversation. And I think the best results are when it's truly two-way and we're using the oldest forms of communication, our listening skills, not just the new technology skills.
Right. Now, Joe, you've been attempting to do this, right? The way that you've put it on record is trying to renegotiate the relationship between a news organization and the people we used to call the audience, right? What's that been like? I mean, you've spent the past year in the Missourian newsroom with a team of people attempting to do what Stephanie just said, right? Mm-hmm. To listen to the community. How's that gone?
It's been lots of fun, and it's a constant experiment. So basically, we're trying to figure out what Columbia wants in general, what relationship the Missourian could have with its community. But more specifically, the really exciting parts happen when we get down to individual stories or projects. So if we're trying to cover poverty, I mean, that roundtable is fantastic. I love that the Tribune did that. The approach, you know, this is Sam's world, when the transit budget was up for debate in the fall and the most controversial part of the city budget was transit, we took 2 weeks worth of reporting on really in-depth, fantastic reporting on the transit budget and turned it into a two-page flyer and took it to the city council meeting, figuring the people who most need that information are going to be there. And we want the debate around the budget to be infused with not just the strong emotion that we knew would be present, but also with facts. And we figure if these people haven't found our content, we should take it to them. So that's an example of identifying the audience. And in that way, you know, Stephanie's point about the ears, it doesn't get more analog than that. We took a whole bunch of information, made it easy to process, mm-hmm. put it on the front and back of a piece of paper, and went out and handed it out.
And this gets at a question that came up from somebody named David in the chat room. How did you sell that idea, the need for that kind of engagement up the chain? I mean, getting management buy-in for some things that seem so far out of the norm, how did you do that? What was that like?
You know, and I'm lucky to work in a newsroom that values experimentation and innovation. I think it would be a harder sell in some other ones. But really, we were offering to do it. I wasn't asking busy editors and reporters. Well, that's not true in this case. The reporter did help us distill. He knew way more about this information than most people in town, and he helped us distill it into the tight package. And then we said, we'll do the rest. We're going to go hand it out. And, you know, really, we handed out 100 copies and had people asking for more. And we saw, before the city council meeting, people informing themselves through our coverage, which is our goal around the whole coverage of city budget, is we want people to understand it. So if we put that on our website and in our newspaper and hope that some of it sticks in people's brain and influences the public conversation, I think we can do better than that. I think we can go further.
Right. Jana, what sort of listening strategies do you coach organizations to carry out?
Well, I really appreciate Stephanie's comment because it really comes down to a very core moment. If you've ever had a kid show up on your door selling you gift wrap, it's really hard to say no to a person when someone actually wants to talk to you and ask you to do something or to mm-hmm. make a gift. It is still the case that asking someone to give face-to-face yields the most dollars, that you get the best percentage return, if you will. So I think that is a starting point. What I think is interesting is that donors do feel more activist than they used to feel. For example, an individual may want to make a gift to an organization or decide that they care very much about hunger in a certain community, but they want to tell you how the program should be built. They want to specifically direct either one component of it or serve on a board in a volunteer capacity, but they have something to say. That wasn't as much the case maybe 20 years ago, but that is increasingly so. I think it's maybe a demographic issue, that you've got a population of folks who are used to being bosses and used to being in charge for whatever reason, but I think that's true.
And used to having the tools to be able to do that.
Right.
It used to be that if you want to get in touch with a news organization, you have to show up or look up the phone number or write a letter, and it's just too easy now. And too many brands, including news organizations, use digital tools as another way to get the message out. Mm-hmm. And the most valuable engagement happens when you learn how to take the more sophisticated step and to hear what people are giving you mm-hmm. back. And, if that donor wants to have ideas about how the organization is run,
right.
There should be a platform for that person to be heard and to get some feedback and to know that they were heard.
I think it's an interesting moment where the listener and the organization decide who's the activist in the conversation, that they are maybe they're the ones that are telling an organization how to operate instead of the organization saying, here's how we're going to manage this concern.
Interesting. There's a comment in the chat room from Marty who says, this is the quote from Marty, I appreciate what Joy is saying. I think the perception of social engagement is that it takes place behind or in front of a screen. And I think all organizations, newsrooms, and nonprofits alike could benefit from returning to getting out and actually interacting with people in real life. That's a comment from Marty in our chat room. I want to bring in another audience participant to join our conversation here today. Please share with our audience who you are and what your comment or question is.
Hi. Excuse me. I'm Karen Mitchell, and I'm a journalism instructor here. I was wondering how engagement works with a company like Apple, which has seemed to be incredibly successful, run by a man who doesn't care what anyone else thinks about the products he makes. Is that an anomaly, or do you think that could Apple be even more successful if they open themselves up more to interaction from their users?
It's a good question. I mean, Apple is a company that's known for a tremendously loyal following among its customers. Any of our panelists want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, in advancement or fundraising, there's a role for a super endorser where, for example, you decide you're going to run a race and you ask all of your friends to give money to support you in that race. They are giving because they trust that you believe in the cause. And I remember University of Michigan, which was one of the earliest Apple adopters as a platform in many, many of the colleges, you just kind of bought in because everyone was buying in, to some degree, that you believed and trusted the people that had made the decision with the authority that this was where to go. And, I like my iPhone. I don't love my iPhone, but I wanted one. and I got one. And I think that speaks to, the motivation. You do have a gentleman who designed a product who was so specific and so mindful of what it would do. And we trusted him that this is the right way to go.
Okay.
I think that's what I was going to key on. I can't give you an example regarding Apple, whether or not that would work in this community. But without the trust and respect factor, you're going to offend more individuals than you would actually listen to what they have to say, and they can actually measure that relationship based on what you're doing rather than what you're saying. So it's important that you're listening and that also that they know that you're invested in what they want to happen in the community.
Right. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and remind everyone once again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we are live in the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the MU campus having a town hall discussion about community engagement. Joining me in the studio are Jana Byington-Smith, a donor retention expert and founder of ROI Philanthropy Partners, Joy Mayer, the director of community outreach for the Columbia, Missouri News Organization, and Sam Robinson, director of healthy community initiatives for PedNet. We've also heard from many of our audience participants, Stephanie Padgett from the Journalism School at Mizzou, Darren Priest from Central Missouri Community Action. We'd like to thank them and you for participating, and we'll be back after a short break. Stick around. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're at the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the MU campus having a town hall discussion about community engagement. Joining me in the forum today are Jana Byington-Smith, a donor retention expert and founder of ROI Philanthropy Partners, Joy Mayer, the director of community outreach for the Columbia, Missouri News Organization, and Sam Robinson, director of healthy community initiatives for PedNet. For those of you in our audience, what are some mistakes you've seen organizations make as they attempt to get people involved and to, as we just heard, build their trust? We'd love to hear your story. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And I want to bring in some more members of our audience today, so we'll go ahead and get started with that.
I'm Nick Foster. I'm director of Voluntary Action Center. And you all started where I would start with this subject, and that is the matter of passion. I heard that word used more or less several times. And it's easy to get people engaged in those places where they are passionate, and that's the first place you want to do. And really, when it comes to long-term involvement, that's where they're more likely to stay involved. But I'm curious about other issues or other areas where people may not be immediately passionate or unaware, where there are matters like in this community. We've discovered in a recent study that about 40% of our community members don't really have any interaction with people of low income. And that's a problem when you're addressing poverty. You need for people to be aware of poverty and be involved in it to one degree or another. So I'm curious how the panel might respond to that. How do you raise awareness and raise interest and maybe even inject a little passion in some areas where it may not automatically or immediately exist?
That's a good question. Who'd like to take a stab at that?
That is a good question. Outside of the passion, I think the evidence based models that exist throughout the country is a great starting point, but you have to make sure that you cater it to the needs of your intended audience. I do agree with you that far often we do not look at, as I've stated in the past, thanks to Darren, looking at the environmental scan, and if you are serving people that look just like you, you're missing part of the picture, and you should intentionally reach outside of your scope of interest and people that you know to get a more diverse collective group of people together to move forward. And I think that's something that we did intentionally when we first started our project, is that we engaged community members, not only our institutional partners, but more importantly, individuals living in poverty that's sitting and listening to what was going on in the community. Although I knew that I wanted to focus on child obesity, I had to focus on what was important to them first.
I want to throw that question at one of our experts in the room, Stephanie Padgett, who is on the strategic communications faculty here at the Journalism School. What are some strategies that you can use to get people interested in something that is important but they may not already feel passionate about?
I will use a very personal example from here in the community, and that is starting with their passions. So, for example, I belong on the board of the Columbia Youth Football League, and so playing football doesn't necessarily seem to correlate with poverty. But by getting a group of engaged adults who are passionate about why can't these kids play football, my goodness, I never knew that the $25 change or the raising gas prices and driving to Boonville could keep somebody out of participating. And when you start with those passions and build upon them and show them in ways that are very natural and relate to what they're interested in, I think you have a far greater chance of succeeding rather than trying to compete or say you must do this instead of that. So starting with the passions and showing how those two things relate, I think, are a very good strategy.
Okay. Other ideas?
Well, one of the things that we're working on at the Missourian is connecting with people around their passions, people who might not already feel connected with our news organization. We have a section of our paper called From Readers where people tell their own stories. So somebody who's out storm chasing last weekend can use the Missourian to have the community learn about his passion for storm chasing. And as I'm looking around the room and meeting so many people, I think I need to be issuing specific invitations to people to say, this is a space for people to raise awareness about something that matters to them. So the passion then is not about the Missourian, and it's not about even whether it's possible for readers to tell their own stories in the newspaper. It's about you want to let the room know about, the community know about something that you're really proud of that your kid did or that an organization did or a cause that you think people should raise awareness of. So it's not, I need to engage with you not about the Missourian, but about your storm chasing, or your dad's birthday party, or the youth football league.
What about the specific question? I mean, I'm going to kick this and push a little bit. Mm-hmm. So there's a statistic that a high number of people in Colombia are needing assistance for food-related issues or just income-related issues. The Colombia Public Schools has a very high percentage of students receiving free or reduced-price lunch qualification. Mm-hmm. You have that statistic as somebody at the Missourian. You also just heard the statistic that 40%, I think, of Colombia's population doesn't interact with people of low income. What do you do with that?
I think that there, I think probably more people interact with people of low income than they realize. It's not something you can always see.
Exactly.
So I think ways to make that clear, and maybe it's the picture of poverty in Colombia not always looking like you think it's going to look. My outreach team actually went to several PTA meetings in the fall. We were doing a series on working on some coverage of poverty in schools and how it affects schools. So going to where the people who are actually working on that and saying, what do you wish the rest of the community knew about this? I think it's listening.
Yeah. I think people forget to talk about people. So we can talk about statistical measure, we can look at saturation of issue, but my son's school, I found out two kids in his class didn't eat over the weekend. I mean, they just didn't have food. And they went home on a bus, and so we all put backpacks together that were discreet, and we filled them with food, so we knew they had peanut butter and bread and things to eat. And the picture of a child or a person you need, you know, who needs service is a really powerful message. And to know kids love football, I think that's a great example. Mm-hmm. That a picture of a kid with a football is a joyful picture. And I think joy in engagement is really important. And it's important for giving, because when fundraising is actually joyful. I mean, there are people who are kind of hesitant about it and think it's challenging, but it's engagement with a different tool. And when someone makes a gift for something they're passionate about or something they care about, and they make it for an amount that they feel comfortable with, and they make it at a time when it works for them, they're more likely to come back and give again. It is a really powerful motivator.
So the picture of the kid with the football can be a tipping point that makes it...
Exactly.
That makes somebody connect with it. My family and I volunteer at the food bank, and I have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they were fine about this idea of volunteering at the food bank. But when they saw the buddy packs, the line of backpacks, and understood that that meant that kids at their school needed the backpacks full of food for the weekend, it mattered to them. They have a different connection with that service than they would have.
Exactly.
And have you all found other things that work in terms of messaging and trying to get people involved in activities? What do you say? What's the appeal to individuals that actually causes them to cross that line of thinking into action?
Well, I want to make a point that it's not always what we're saying. People are concerned how much you know, how much you're going to help them reduce their weight or whatever. They want to know how much you care about my everyday situation. And once they really feel safe that you understand their plight, our plight as a community, they're more engaged, they're more involved, and I've just seen it in my walk of my work, in my setting, that they will more or less take on leadership roles that you would not normally put them in. So speaking to messaging, I'm very sensitive to make sure that, we put out pamphlets that are just a lot of pictures and less words, and we're more talking about how we can succeed as a community rather than give them all the statistical analysis of poverty and all those things are important. I don't think that's what's resonating in our community members.
Right. Okay. Another comment from our audience, participation.
Sam's not one to take a lot of credit. I have to just point out that Sam and the PedNet Coalition are probably the best at engaging the community as far as what I've seen in the last couple of years. They do a phenomenal job of reaching out. And particularly, I mean, it's led by a white, middle-class British guy, and I think one of the keys to the success of that organization are its tirelessness. You can't just put out a flyer and expect people are going to show up and you're going to have, you're going to change the world. You have to build those relationships. You have to continually be out in the community. You have to show your face. And it doesn't matter necessarily if you're white or black. Sometimes being able to reflect the population you're trying to serve matters in terms of opening that door. But if you're tireless and you keep after it and you're passionate about it and people start to see that there is real passion underneath that process, that's where you're going to start to have some effect. I wanted to comment, too, the comment earlier about two-way communication is just so – it's a fundamental piece of this conversation, because while it's critically important that you open the door to two-way communication, we have to recognize that when you open the door to two-way communication, it might lead you in a different direction than what you thought. And that's good and bad. It's good because you go where, really the interest is and where the commitment and the passion is. But, you know, in some cases you have grants, you have funders, you have people that you are accountable to and responsible to. And so you have to maintain some kernel of that original road, even while branching off at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's really difficult for any nonprofit to do. It's one thing when you've got a Steve Jobs and almost unlimited resources, but when you're a nonprofit that's living on those grants, and I'm not a fan of fundraising myself, but you got to do it. You got to do it. It makes such a big difference. But you can't take every $1,000 donor and say, we're going to do what you want us to do, because you have such a broad continuum of commitments.
I think that's interesting, because sometimes the people who give money see the role of an organization and its engagement in its community as a whole, not necessarily as the individual services. And Joey and I were talking a little bit about publications. We have mutual friends, and that sometimes the people who give are not the people who use the service. They see the role of the organization in a different way. And the accountability to them is that they see it addresses an issue that they know their community won't thrive if it's not covered. They still, you know, expect the people who are maybe the end users of the service should not be discounted as people who will also, when they can or if they can, play a role in the funding.
Yeah, well, this gets at a question that I want to throw out there that came in from our chat room. Roger in the chat room asks, you know, is the model for journalists, you know, we've talked a little bit about journalism, we're at a journalism institute, is the model for journalists closer to what we've been talking about with nonprofits in terms of dealing with donors and volunteers and that sort of a structure, or is it more in line with the commercial firms like Apple that are trying to build that kind of loyalty following as opposed to activating its following on behalf of something? Joy, what do you think on that question?
I think that it probably depends newsroom by newsroom whether the goal is to, sell more product, which might we're fighting for attention so that we can get advertising dollars, or whether the goal is, you know, public media might have a different take on that than commercial media would. But in general, if we're looking for a gift of time, I'm looking for a donation of time and attention, people like to feel like they're helping. And one of my favorite ways to engage with the community is when they help make our journalism better, because we ask ahead of time. We say, we're working on a story about this. Who can help us? And we hear from people like Sam, who might say, if we say, I'm working on a story and it connects with Sam's world, he's going to then, if he takes time to say, you really should ask this question and you really should talk to this person, then he feels a connection with me, and don't think I'm not going to hit you up after this. He feels a connection with what I'm doing. He might be likely to share it. He's going to make it better, and then he is a donor in my mind of his expertise and his time.
Well, you know, that's I love that question, because it hits upon my number one pet peeve about the kind of understanding of nonprofit. Nonprofits are for profit; they are for profit. It's just the stakeholders that are different. It's not necessarily that they're going to get a check. The stakeholders are the people who receive the services. Right. It's the energy in the population. Non-governmental organization is the word I'd like to use. It has different context in different parts of the world. But we shouldn't forget that blend is, there is a blend, but there is a difference, and it doesn't always cross over.
So how would you make the distinction? I mean, it's a little side point, but okay, so say we use non-governmental organization, then how do you distinguish between them and, you know, a company like Doritos or something? I mean, is that worth making that distinction?
No. I love Doritos. to be really broad about the concepts, I'd say you've got, you know, government, you've got corporate entities, and then you've got this, what they call it, the third estate in the UK. I think that's more commonly phrased. Right. This other organizational element that does what those other two can't. Right. And it exists because those other two can't do those things. It isn't, matter of fact, it's an amazing financial driver. $660 billion in the U.S. in the nonprofit world. It's not like, you know, a little thing. It's a huge thing. And when you give it some sense of perspective, it really kind of completes the triangle. So I do think that we should not forget that nonprofits do serve a profitable end.
Yeah. Interesting that you use the phrase third estate, because in the news world, we talk about the fourth estate as journalism being something outside of those three things you just described.
Exactly.
And yet here we're having a conversation about it behaving similar to the third estate. Interesting. Okay. With that, I will remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we are here in the Reynolds Journalism Institute on the MU campus having a town hall discussion about community engagement. Joining me in the studio are Jana Byington-Smith, a donor retention expert and founder of ROI Philanthropy Partners, Joy Mayer, the director of community outreach for the Columbia Missourian, and Sam Robinson, director of healthy community initiatives for PedNet. For those of you in our audience, what might make you engage more with organizations or companies or even programs like this one? Give us a call. Share your thoughts. 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to move on to another question that came up in the chat room. It was the second half of a question that I asked. And the second half is, how do you measure whether this stuff is working? Joy, I'm going to start with you because I know you had a whole conference on this.
My fingers go like this.
I did. It's so... It's so important as we try new things, to, especially as, you know, in these economic times and every organization and company is feeling the pinch, that we assess whether what we're doing is working. So as this experiment known as community outreach at the Missourian takes shape, we are trying projects with a mind for knowing from the beginning, how will we know what success would look like here? What are we actually getting at? What's the goal? And that is not just as a newspaper. It is for individual projects. And I think it translates across businesses. And seeing failure, not as failure, but as we tried that, people didn't seem to want to work with us there. So let's try it this way. Or we did this little thing over here, and that seemed to work really well, so we're going to do that again. And I think, you know, metrics for success are sometimes eyeballs and attention. And when we're talking about online ventures, that's easier to manage. That project I talked about with taking flyers to the city council meeting, it was success that people were happy to have it, that people took them from us and were consuming the information before they went up. You know, there's no in that case, it was more attitudinal, I guess. We had a thing we were going for it and felt at the end of the night like it was worth the time.
But what was interesting to me earlier is that you specifically referenced the fact that you had to get more, that there was a quantitative measure for you that was real, that you had, because, and I think that happens because people know how much it costs. I think that's the backside of measurement, is that you do want to spend the money on the thing where you get the most yield. It just absolutely makes sense. But we are trained by default to look less, to not give enough credit for the cost behind some of the engagement. For an organization or a nonprofit is worth, in a lot of nonprofit circles, about $5.35. In a year value, that's around $212 to $220. It's a stunning amount of money if you look at the research investment and then the actual expenditure of having a community manager, an engagement manager that makes those likes happen. And I think we forget that measurement cost and should absolutely give credit for it. We should not lose that measurement cost.
Sam, how do you guys assess success on these engagement things?
We have both quantitative and qualitative measures in place, so we have an evaluation of our project ongoing on a monthly and a yearly basis. Recently, we just held our annual Healthy Community Partnerships Dinner where we kind of gave a summary of our outcomes or achievements from last year and also more or less a vision cast of what we want to accomplish this year. And by the request from news media and our partners being engaged, we are being very successful.
Right. And what were some of those things that you reported out as demonstrations of success?
We were able to, through a joint use agreement, through the Department of Public Works, the Health Department, PedNet, and other partners, start a half-acre community garden adjacent to the Health Department in an area that was deemed otherwise unsuitable for vegetation. Of course, the Common Campaign, our Columbia for Modern and Efficient Transit. We have a youth engagement component. I agree with Darren. It's a youth-led partnership. I see in the background, and I let them know that I'm here to support your efforts, not to tell you what you should do. In 2011, we walked 15 teens ages 15 to 18 through a 10-week course to teach them about the impacts their built environment, social and economic environment that will be more conducive to a healthy lifestyle. So, and those same kids are engaged on a monthly basis. Those are just a few of our achievements, and we want to continue our access to healthy foods and vegetables at our farmers market. So it's across the spectrum, as we stated, Joy, but we're specifically targeting our underserved community members in our community.
Right. I love that you planned to tell people about it, which sometimes that's forgotten. Mm-hmm. You had an event. I mean, yes. In itself, that's an investment in an engagement. You want to tell people that you did things, you did them well, you completed them, and that's heartening to hear. We sometimes forget to tell people that this has worked. It's more frequent than we'd hope.
And if I can answer that, I'm glad you brought that up. I think there's also a political dynamic that we don't often talk about. You can gain political goodwill by having champions, and we have great champions on our city council who are really focusing on some of the same issues and the vision of our organization. So transit is just one of those issues that at this time is kind of a political no-starter to be on the wrong side of that issue. So you want to more or less support transit and have these community conversations around transit rather than say, I don't want to be involved in that process. Right. But at the end of the day, it's about the community members telling us what they would like to see. And it's our responsibility. More specifically, my staff and I's responsibility to make sure it happens.
Right.
So it's interesting that I think the more time you invest in this, the more efficient you become. And that's something we're really working on, is how success, the return on that investment, the more efficient we get. So for example, it's interesting to me that you have champions on the city council. I would think the same way. If I had some coverage that I thought people in your network of connections would be interested in, if I am tapped into, clued into the community enough that I know, hey, if I get that to Sam and he decides it's valuable and he sends it to his mm-hmm. friends, then by virtue of having done my job well and knowing who the thought leaders are in that area, I can draw a lot of mm-hmm. attention to something I think is really important, as opposed to I'm going to spam the community with this message and really hope that it resonates with somebody. So what we look for mm-hmm. in metrics of success is sometimes, did we do this more efficiently than before? Mm-hmm. And is sometimes, did we do it better than before?
There's actually a really great example out of the professional world that's been interesting to follow how people use engagement, and it's the airline industry. And if you think about the airline industry, most people engage when they've had a negative experience. My bag is lost, my flight is late, I'm unhappy. And when you look in the world of the airline industry and talking about those resources, a couple of the newer, airlines, Southwest and JetBlue, decided to put a lot of resources into answering those concerns immediately, listening and engaging at the worst moment, to where there are now stories of Southwest greeting people to negate that problem mid-flight. Contrast that with some of the more legacy carriers like Delta, who don't seem to, an American, that don't listen to those pain points and wait to respond. And I think you can look at values as well as some PR meters and success meters to see how those two ways of engaging have helped or hurt their airlines. But make no mistake, it's very expensive. As you were talking about, they shifted their resources from people taking reservations, we can have people do that online, to people solving problems real time because they listened. So I think that's a commercial venture that is a good model we can learn from.
I love that model. Because
thanks, Stephanie.
The price of a Honeycrisp apple at my grocery store was $2.76 last year, and I posted it on their webpage. I'm like, holy cow, I pay $7 for two apples. And they never responded. They never said anything. They didn't put it on their Twitter feed. They didn't do it. I mean, and I wasn't counting on too much, but that back channel investment is lost all the time. And it's a golden moment to grab a problem and turn it around and to hear more about what you'll do better next time.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You said you weren't expecting very much. And this gets to a comment that came in from the chat room again. So this is the comment. Sometimes intrinsic motivation isn't sufficient to move someone to engage. Extrinsic motivation through things like badges or other forms of recognition can be useful in inducing engagement. What's your experience with extrinsic motivators? Joy, you're nodding here on this.
Well, just because I was talking earlier on the program about social identity, and we did some experimenting during this last election. We actually made a little badge that says I voted, like a virtual I voted sticker. We were playing around with the idea of civic pride mm-hmm. and how voting in an election, I love to wear my I voted sticker. I love for people to say, oh, that's right, there's an election today. So we had a whole little campaign around inviting people to, through the Missourian, sort of brag about their civic involvement. We had a Facebook album of people wearing their I voted stickers. A couple of the city council candidates sent us in their own pictures of them with their I voted stickers. Some editors did it. So it's this idea of it will, we've had some good luck where there's civic pride involved mm-hmm. in encouraging people to share. If it's something that I kind of want to brag about, then it makes me feel good to be part of it.
Right. I love Foursquare. As a matter of fact, I get mocked. I know. So one of my favorite uses of
For those who are unfamiliar, Foursquare is a web-based thing that you can check mm-hmm. into places when you show up there, right?
It uses your geolocator service on your smartphone.
Right.
And you can earn badges for all sorts of good and reckless things, I guess, sometimes. But one of the best uses of it is in the nonprofit sector, I think, is a good example is the American Red Cross, where they arranged with the Foursquare corporate office and they made a badge for a donation day. And if you checked in at a donor site, you were able to get that badge. Foursquare is really stingy. It's not like they just give out badges for anybody. And so for them, that was a major achievement. And I think I have friends who will never have that badge. Mm-hmm. It's just mine.
Well, and you have friends who couldn't care less. So that just speaks to the need to meet people where they mm-hmm. are and to target the message for specific parts of the audience and to realize that not one thing is going to work for everybody.
You know what changed minds? When I told people how much money, how much free stuff I get from Foursquare.
Yeah.
You know, I have $200 from Walgreens. I got $125 worth of free coffee over the holidays because you can work the system, and it became more than extrinsic. It became really valuable for me, and I like to see how people are using that model to talk to someone in a place as opposed to behind a screen.
Okay. We have a fair number of journalists in our audience today, and I want to get to another question that came in from the chat room. Specifically, how do you get a newsroom to put time in the front end to develop engagement efforts? It takes an initial investment of time to make something catch on, even for a big nonprofit newsroom. So how do you make that happen within a news organization at the beginning so that it will pay these dividends after the trust has been developed and after the stuff is in place?
Well, in my newsroom, we make the most of little successes. So when a reporter comes to me and says, I'm working on this story, do you think you could help me find sources? That is a specific need that she has to find people with expertise on something. When we then post something on our Facebook page saying we're working on a story about this, what happens next can be awesome. If people weigh in and say, you know, maybe they're sources, maybe they're not, but if they say, be sure to ask this question or don't use that word, how can that's totally offensive. That's the wrong take for the story completely. Then her job has become so much easier if she takes into account how do we get all the people who are going to hate on the story after it publishes, let them know we're working on it, have this conversation, whole conversation that's happening before we would have normally just hit publish and walk away. So it's, for me, showing how it can make your job easier. And also, don't we want people to read what we do? We use analytics information, and if I can say to reporters, did you send that link to the people you talked to? Do they have a Facebook page you can put it on? You know, it feels sort of self-promotional, which a lot of journalists aren't comfortable with, and yet there is a built-in audience for your story. Go find them. Maybe it's Sam. Send all your stories to Sam.
And before we all do that, I need to go ahead and close out today's program. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. I'd like to thank our guests, Jana Byington-Smith, a donor retention expert and founder of ROI Philanthropy Partners, Joy Mayer, the director of community outreach for the Columbia, Missouri News Organization, and Sam Robinson, Director of Healthy Community Initiatives for PedNet, soon to be recipient of all your stories. Thanks also to the people in our audience who participated in our conversation today. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Leah Becerra and Danny Madison. Pat Akers and Ryan Femuliner were our audio engineers today. I'm Ruben Stern. I'd like to thank you all for joining us, and have a great week.